With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of JavaScript Jabber. Today on our panel, we have Amy Knight.
Hey, hey, from Nashville.
AJ O'Neill.
Yo, 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 coming at you live from Hematoma.
Myself, Dan Shapir, playing the host. And we've got two guests this time, both of them from the same company. The company, I think, whose name is Sneak, but we'll learn about that more in a bit. And our guests are Brian Vermeer from the Netherlands and Liran Tal, also from Israel. So hi, you guys.
Hey, Dan.
We usually like to start podcasts with a quick introduction of our guests. So you choose who goes first. But if you can give us a brief background about yourselves, why we should know about you, what makes you famous in the community, and what's the stuff that you want to talk with us about today.
Go for
All
it,
right, Brian. Cool. Oh, okay. I'm the least famous one of us two, probably. So my name is Brian Vermeer. I am based in the Netherlands in a city called Breda, which is close to the Belgian border. What I do, I am a developer advocate and engineer for Sneak, and you pronounced it correctly. I mean, what makes me famous? I don't think I am famous at all, but what we do is we try to get that, we try to talk about security and get security and make security easy for developers. That's the basic goal we want to strive, and that's within the JS ecosystem, but it's in many, many different ecosystems that we try to do that. And we have our leaders and our people that make a lot of noise about that. And I think that's the point where Liran comes in, because he's very much more famous within here than I probably am.
Yeah, no, not famous, but I'm probably mostly known for my role around the Node security working group, Node.js security book I wrote and things around that. So just like Brian, I'm trying to advocate as much as we can for developers and security around those spaces and in Node and JavaScript. And so Brian is completing me in a sense. He's coming from the Java ecosystem. So I think a constant engagement between us is trolling each other back and forth. And that's the fun part of the day-to-day job.
Cool.
I'm glad he still finds it today. He still thinks it's fun. That's a good thing. So the work relationship is still healthy. That's good to hear.
Leveling up is important. I spend at least an hour every day learning ways I can improve my business or take a break and listen to a good book. If you're looking to level up, I recommend you start out with the 12-week year as a system to plan out where you want to end up and how to get the results you want. You can get it free by going to audibletrial.com/code. That's audibletrial.com/code.
Well, when a Java and JavaScript developer can get along, that's definitely a good thing. You know, despite the commonality in the name, there tend to be significant differences in outlook on life and stuff. By the way, Liran, talking about famous, I think that you also made a notable contribution to web page tests recently.
Oh, indeed. Yeah. Thank you for noticing that and mentioning. We've actually reached out to Patrick. He's a great guy. And we worked on adding the security part of performance testing. Just giving you a whole 360 kind of view when you test websites. So you're now educated about security issues in your websites as much as we can tell about them.
We should talk about that. That sounds really interesting.
Definitely.
Yeah, good thing we have Liran on our podcast then. So you know what? Let's talk about that. Why not? Let's start with that even. Webpagetest.org, for those of you who don't know, is an excellent online utility that you can just go to that website, webpagetest.org, put in the URL of your web page, And then it just does a whole bunch of tests on it. Essentially, it loads it in a virtual machine somewhere. You can specify where, emulating whatever browser, or actually using whatever browser you prefer, and recording all the activity that takes place. So it records the network activity, it records the CPU activity, and so on and so forth. Because they actually have access to the virtual machine itself, they have a lot of information about what's going on, and then they present a really detailed view. So for example, in the context of the network, you get an excellent waterfall of all the network requests, when they started, when they finished, so on and so forth. You can also see screenshots, so you can correlate between resource downloads and what a visitor actually sees at any point in time. And then you added stuff to that. So maybe you can tell us in more detail what exactly you added.
Yeah, that's a really good description of what WebEdgeDist is. I guess worth noting, it's an open source project, so you can run it, you know, host it if you needed to, or just, yeah, trigger the public API and just use that. And indeed, it kind of focuses, it's, you know, for created, you know, by and for the web performance community, and has a lot of like top metrics, like first byte time, you know, keep alive enabled, all of those like top level scores. I think it tries to do some accessibility. I'm not totally sure, like, you know, to which extent. But yeah, what was essentially missing is, you know, giving users who use that a security score. So whatever we can tell them, I think it's worth noting that, you know, there's no, like, it's not a pen testing tool. There's nothing like too aggressive and obtrusive about it. It's anything that we can figure out about what you're actually using, you know, from externally testing a website. And basically that is, we have access to figure out the DOM, right? Whatever JavaScript libraries you're actually using. And the other part is, we know from the server responses which HTTP security headers are being returned. So if you're having like a content security policy, or you're not having that, we can note those things. So I would say the major success with web page test enabling and having security by default is the fact that we're now having, you know, a ton more users and developers, you know, using web page test, super aware about their security posture for the website, right? And I think that's like the most important thing. And as they go and explore what kind of score they got, and, you know, what are the steps needed to fix it and make things a bit, you know, in a safer state, you know, we're giving them tools and actions and how to make that happen.
So in case people aren't aware how it looks, at the top right-hand side of the web page test results screen, you get grades from A to F, and they also have a color code, so it's easy to tell whether it's good or bad. And I think the first one on the left, like the very first score, is actually the new security score that you added. And then if you click it, then you get to that part, which actually I think describes why you got the score that you got and what you should focus on improving or fixing or rectifying, whatever, correct?
True, indeed.
So I think this is very cool and very useful. And I think also indicative of the kind of stuff that you're doing and the things that we're going to be talking about today, which is introducing tooling that help developers create more secure software, correct?
Yep. It's kind of the goal, right? Like, how do we make security easier? How do we make it part of the workflow rather than something, you know, that's, you know, adding more friction? So we want to lower that down and make it easier for you as a developer to fix whatever security issues are there. And yeah, I think Brian can we've done a bunch of things. Super interesting. Brian has been leading some of them. So Brian, do you want to share more about some of the other experiments that we've been doing?
Yeah, definitely. I think the key point in this is that as a developer, you have a certain way of working, and everybody's way can be different. Either you want something that is included in your IDE, or myself, for instance, I'm more of the command line tools. So instead of forcing you with a certain tool that works in a certain way, we try to integrate our capabilities of scanning, for instance, your dependencies for vulnerabilities. We try to integrate that in many different ways. And one of the things we did recently was we created an extension together with some folks from the community. And that extension is called Vulncast. It's for VS Code. And what we try to do there is intertwine that knowledge we have about a dependency right into your IDE. So if you, for instance, try to import a certain package, you will definitely see it directly in line if that package you're trying to import, that specific version, if it has a vulnerability or not. And by a click of a button, if you can fix it up by moving to a newer version or not. And we try to do that in many different ways. Like, for instance, when you're actually coding, so you have a JS file open or a TypeScript file open, but also if you're editing your package.json, for instance. So in many different ways, because we found out that developers just work in, well, they have different ways of working, and we want to help them out. Instead of creating new process, like how to do it, we want them to adopt the tooling that fit their process. And I think that is the most important thing if you want to supply tooling for something like security.
So you said, what was the name of the extension again, exactly?
Vulncast. Vuln as in vulnerability, and the cost on, yeah, how much it costs, how much depth you actually create with that. So
I'm about to add it right now.
It is part of the VS Code marketplace, and it has a logo with a little padlock on it with a dollar sign on. And if you install it, what it immediately tries to do is it looks at, if it's a standalone JavaScript file, it parses out the JavaScript files and looks, using an API, it looks if there are known vulnerabilities, and it picks the latest one, because at that point we know not exactly which one you're using, unless you are using a CDN or so in that kind of fashion. But otherwise, if you're using NPM, for instance, we're usually looking at your whole project, and we are looking at which version you actually imported and show you which version it is. And if you connect it to an existing Sneak account, which we need for the remediation advice, which is actually free, by the way, but we need to access that part of the API. We needed to have a token for that. Then you can actually have that advice like, okay, you're using a version 1.2 and you need 1.2.2, for instance, to get it fixed, to get that specific vulnerability fixed that is in there, or to lower the amount of vulnerabilities. And to get it as easy out as that, we believe that that will engage developers more to actually fix it instead of leaving it, first creating the new features and afterwards trying to fix it, which we found out costs a lot more frustration, or makes up for a lot more frustration and a lot of rework, because then people found out that they are using, that they need to use a newer version, and that actually broke API. And then that's the hassle. So if you import it and you see it right away, then you can already figure out, hey, maybe I should use the newer version.
Just to give people listening like an idea, because I literally just installed it. I'm not seeing anything in my files yet, but I'm like looking at your documentation that's pulled up in VS Code. So it kind of looks like, reminds me of like ESLint, where it's just going to like underline where it is. And then like I can see like somebody's importing Express or requiring Express. And it says there's like 6 vulnerabilities.
Exactly. And it shows in line, it shows the number of vulnerabilities and if you can fix it or not.
In terms of the remediation suggestions, it's essentially suggesting just to update to a version that has a fix for that particular issue?
Yes. What we do is we look at the package, and the package can have multiple vulnerabilities. So that means every vulnerability can be fixed in a different version. But then we look, okay, what is the common version in that fixes all of them? Or if that fixes the most vulnerabilities, let me say it like that, because it can still be that there is a vulnerability that cannot be fixed yet. That is the new remediation advice we give, because if you use a version that is way outdated, and then it can be that in a newer version, say a newer bug fix, one of the vulnerabilities is fixed, but 3 versions up, more vulnerabilities will be fixed. So we give you the nearest version that actually fixes the vulnerabilities. That will probably not be the latest and greatest, can be, but we will give the one with the smallest delta that does remediate as much vulnerabilities as possible.
So outside of, you know, using it in VS Code, do you guys build out other tooling as well? Let's say I want to like update something in package.json and then I do an NPM install. Do you guys have tooling around that as well?
Yes, definitely. We have all sorts of tooling available. I think the easiest way is to download the Sneak CLI that can basically do everything and is in some ways the engine for a lot of the other stuff that we do. By doing a sneak test with that CLI, if you're authenticated with a free account, if you do that in the root folder of your, well, in this case, your Node application, it will pick up your package.json. It will look at the dependency tree. It will gather the dependency tree, sends the dependency tree over to our side of the system, and we just cross-check if there are any vulnerabilities, what the severity of the vulnerabilities are, and if there is a remediation advice and what that remediation advice can be. And then we show you basically inline, or in your terminal, we show you in a report of what should you fix to, or what, or to what version should you upgrade to fix what kind of vulnerabilities. And that is the way you do it on your local machine. But we can integrate with CI systems in that part. You can connect your repository to our SaaS solution and basically scan it on a daily basis that you get actively notified when there is a new vulnerability found or a new fix found for a vulnerability that was already there. We do a bunch of integrations for other ecosystems as well. So we have all bits and pieces that in the baseline, we do the same thing, looking at your third-party libraries and see if there are known vulnerabilities and what the severity of that is. But we can supply that information to you in very different ways and in very different stages of your software development lifecycle.
Yeah, that CLI is pretty versatile. Having so today, it can also support and scan things like Docker images, which, you know, usually developers also kind of maintain and use, or if you're like, you know, on the advanced side of 2D SRE, like doing Kubernetes and stuff like that, we're also scanning those. So it's kind of like a one CLI to rule them all and be very handy in those aspects.
I was away from the podcast for a minute, so hopefully I didn't miss something that you said, but I just to verify something, to make sure that I understand. The tool, the extension for VS Code, which is free, that gives you information just within your development environment, again, going to your database, assuming you've got the token. But if I want a more of an enterprise solution that works, let's say, with a team of developers or integrates with my DevOps processes, CI/CD, whatever, then I would use one of the Sneak products, correct?
Exactly. You can use one of the Sneak products.
I wouldn't position it specifically as an enterprise thing, because you just might do that for like a small team or like, you know, your open source project. So you could still connect it and, you know, win all the same stuff, you know, getting an automatic pull request to fix it and so on. So it's all part of like the offering, which is anyway free. So
cool. But in the VS Code extension, that just provides me essentially all this information from within the development environment. And I can just click it and it will just go and patch the packet JSON for me automatically, or does it just point out the problems and then I would need to go and patch the packet JSON?
It points out the problems in this case. For now, we look at what version you're using and to what version you should remediate, and then you have to do that yourself, because if we do that by the click of a button, we feel like we are too intrusive into the process of a developer. So now you can choose if you want to update that one or maybe even use a newer version. So we give you all the information, and then you have to, or well, command line, and use your command line tool or your terminal to install a newer version via npm, or change your package.json exactly the way you want it to work, and then, well, basically relock your application, assuming you're using npm.
Cool. But sometimes I guess picking between versions is almost kind of choosing the lesser of evils, I would guess. I would assume that in some situations, whatever I choose, there are going to be vulnerabilities there. So how do you handle situations like that?
I would basically say step by step, because you start with a version, and that version might not have a certain vulnerability, or that might have vulnerabilities, but might not have a certain vulnerability that is discovered later on in a newer version. So it can actually be that you create something or patch something in or pick a newer version, and then you end up with a total new package of vulnerabilities. And that's why I wanted to say that if you do this early and often, that you find out there are a few vulnerabilities, for instance, and you fix them already, and you go on and on. So the delta of you fixing these kind of things will be small. I believe that is the only good way of working, regardless of which ecosystem or which version or which thing. If you're talking to Docker containers, it's exactly the same, because a newer version can bring in new issues, etc. So do it step by step, and as I believe that all listeners here will be excellent developers, so we have a set of tests available that will make sure that that your program is still working. Fix them one by one, run your test suite to make sure that it's actually still doing the job you need to be doing, and then go on and on and try to go for a level that you're comfortable with. I wouldn't say specifically go for zero vulnerabilities. In the end, of course, you want that, but I can also imagine that some vulnerabilities that you see, and we name them, like, what do these vulnerabilities actually do? What kind of vulnerability is it? And if you know that, like, this one is not so important, or this one is less vulnerable in my situation, because that depends on the context, you might be leaving that. So if you're comfortable with a certain level, you just want to make sure you're not getting worse in a matter of speaking. So again, it depends on your way of working, if you're an individual, if you work in a big team or not. But I would say, again, do it step by step, run your test suite to make sure that it still does the main job, and then fix new ones, and try to make the fixes as soon as possible to make sure that you do not have to up your level or up your dependency or your package to a new major version, which probably will break API.
Yeah, I'd probably add that in terms of those kind of like steps, I think what we're seeing as a dilemma, right, with developers, but in open source and, you know, companies, is how do you lower that signal to noise kind of ratio, right? How do you make it, you know, less friction, less, you know, less swamp and flood developers with issues? And Amy mentioned, you know, it kind of resembles the Slint, which, you know, is something you're trying to also, like, you know, don't want to save a file, commit it, push it, and then linters throws at you 100 linterers, right? But we're still using linters, right? It's a way to kind of like standardize guidelines and, you know, code style and whatever you're using it for. But kind of that's what we're trying to do. And I think that's kind of like the distinctive way that Snyk works, right? Where Brian mentioned the thing about the way that, you know, you were trying to get you to the most minimal simple version possible to create an upgrade. But also by default, you know, what we're scanning for is the prod dependencies. So if you have some stuff in dev dependencies, you know, we may not just, you know, give you that information out of the box. You may opt in for it, but we're trying to really reduce the noise for you as a developer to really focus on the most important things as possible.
And again, when you scan for these kind of things, you can already say, okay, I want to be notified for only severities or only vulnerabilities that have at least having a high severity or are at the level of high. So you have low, medium, and high severity vulnerabilities. Maybe you do not want to get even notified by low severities. So you can pick and choose already in that. Then you just have to make your own reasonable decision if you want to switch these versions out.
Without really shaming anybody, because I think we've all had vulnerabilities in our software. So it's really a reality of building software that you have vulnerabilities. But can you give examples of some of the vulnerabilities that you identify and recommend? So, you know, we kind of get the feeling of what we're talking about.
Yeah, sure. I mean, vulnerabilities come in all different, I guess, sizes and tastes and whatnot. I would add that, you know, some of us also create vulnerabilities. So yeah, not shaming anyone, and me included here, on creating vulnerabilities too. But it's like it's the fact of life, right? You're not creating software in a vacuum, and everything has, you know, bugs and needs some attention and so on. This is kind of the way with things. It's anywhere between having SQL injections and you know, cross-site scripting. So any kind of like these vulnerabilities will be really well fleshed out in terms of, you know, what we report on. I've seen, if you remember, there's been a lot of issues with some popular libraries on the JS ecosystems around prototype pollution. And that has been something that also Snyk really endeavored in a security research. So we've been raising some of these and working with the maintainers to fix them and create patches and so on. And this has been, you know, super received well by the maintainers and, you know, by the community. But to an extent, this is also something that's created a lot of noise, right? Like what extent the prototype pollution would be error sum. So it's not all the time. I think the problem with, you know, with security in a sense is that it's mostly invisible, right? Like when you are super secure, there's, you know, nothing except maybe like a scanner, right? Like this security scan that tells you zero vulnerabilities. But at the same extent, how do you quantify, you know, have 100 vulnerabilities? You know, what's your level of exposure at the moment? Is it the amount of time you have them unpatched? Is it severity level, the CVSS? Is it exploitable? So many things that, you know, you need to take into account to figure out what is your current status. But it's super hard when you don't have the visibility into it. And I think kind of like understanding that even something as prototype pollution is something that would be having very tangible impact on a system, if so to say, it's just important to understand that, you know, this is something that can happen. And I think one of the experiments I've actually done probably about a month or two ago was we have this Goof app, which we use for demos. So if you go to, it's open source. So if you go to like the GitHub repo of Snyk slash goof, you would basically get a JavaScript app end-to-end with a ton of vulnerabilities and also exploits inside and like help you experiment with this and do this. And what I've done is added this prototype pollution in one of the popular ORMs for Node that is, you know, it's vulnerable for SQL injection just because of prototype pollution. So it's true that sometimes, you know, maybe on a front end, maybe in a specific context, you would not be able to exploit a prototype pollution vulnerability or an XSS or, you know, whatever, right? But there's a slight chance that you may not understand, you know, fully the impact and the attack surface, and then you might be vulnerable, like that one example that, you know, creates this SQL injection because of that prototype pollution vulnerability. But you really don't want to take that chance, right? You're leaving the house after you leave, you know, it's like a bit of COVID times right now, but assuming you leave the house and allowed to, you want to close all the doors, right? You want to close all the windows. You want to make sure everything is, you know, tight, and, you know, you're not leaving anything open. And if you're like me, you're probably double checking, you know, everything twice. And so that's kind of like the world we live in with security as well. You do not want to leave that, you know, that small chance that something can go wrong. And you want to do everything in your power, right? It's no need to go into crazy madness, which is what I think Brian was trying to say before. You need to prioritize things and, you know, reach to them with some rationale, right? But at the same time, you need to have a plan to make better, you know, we have a good baseline and improve upon that. So that's kind of like the effort and, you know, the return of investment of investing in your own security in a sense.
Since you mentioned it several times, prototype pollution is essentially the inadvertent problems caused by the fact that the same prototypes are shared across the entire application, right? That if I put something on string.prototype, it impacts every string in the system. So is it more about fact that somebody is maliciously, intentionally putting something on a prototype and changing built-in behavior, or is it something else? Can you elaborate a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So I guess, you pretty much explained it in a very simple term. So that's kind of what it is. I mean, it's very specific also to, you know, JavaScript and the prototype structure, right? So it's a very specific world here that we're talking about. And that's essentially what it means. You have an object. And if we're able to, I guess there's different terminology here, right? If we're able to poison an object in terms of, for example, create an attribute on the base object of JavaScript that says is admin or, you know, whatever else we can think of, then any object created from that object will have is admin as well. And so you can imagine that if there's like a code path where you would be checking, you know, relatively, this is like an example from a backend, for example, where you have this, if something is admin equals true, and if it doesn't exist on the prototype of the current object, it will go up the prototype chain and we'll find it on that root object, which we poisoned. And at that point, we have kind of like circumvented our way into, you know, poisoning that app or that prototype chain to an is admin a value, and maybe have gained unwanted access, right? Access that we shouldn't have gained before. And that happens in different ways, right? That there are different ways to make that happen. One of them is maybe you're processing JSON that is rooted in user input. Maybe you're processing user input not as a JSON, but you're transforming it into a JSON, and your merge is maybe, you know, is maybe an unsecure merge, right? You're maybe doing deep merges inside that tree, which, you know, do not take into account the fact that someone is able to impact the prototype. And so that's kind of like how this evolves. It's one example, right? It's one example, but there are so many.
You remind me of a funny tweet that I recently saw that somebody listed several ways to sum up an array of numbers in JavaScript. So one was a simple for loop. Another one was to use the .reduce method. But the final example was to take that array of numbers, join it with a string plus, and then eval it. So I was really amused with that particular example.
Yeah,
eval and so on.
For sure, yeah. It's something, yeah. And people get after a while, right? If you're aware of it, that's kind of thing that they work with, raising awareness, like you just said, right? You understand the impact of that. And the moment you understand it and you see it, you know, that's the 50% win, right? The next thing is just freaking out what is the solution, what is the alternative. But the moment you see it, it clicks.
Cool. Now, how challenging was it for you to implement this extension for Visual Studio? I know that there are a lot of cool extensions for that. I've personally have not yet built an extension for VS Code. That's something I probably have to do sooner or later. It's becoming a rite of passage almost. So can you talk a little bit about that?
One thing I would add to that question too that I was going to ask earlier, so I'm assuming like there are extensions for other languages too, but I'm kind of curious, like specifically maybe since it's a JavaScript podcast, if there were any complications that I'm assuming there are specifically with JavaScript.
Not so much complications. It was more the structure, how to make it work within Visual Studio Code. That was a challenge.
Okay.
Luckily, we got the idea from, what was the original thing called? I think it was...
Dan probably knows it. Yeah, import cost.
Import cost by the folks from Wix. And we looked at how they built their UI, because they do the inline messaging, like there is something wrong, or you're importing a certain package, and it shows you how much space that package costs you. So from that point of view, we're like, okay, this is nifty. This is very, very, very simple and elegant, and in the way how they presented it. And their code was there. So we built this with their idea. We took their idea and we built our stuff on top of that. So the UI part, well, we got inspired by them, say it like that. And then we connected our own APIs towards that. And then we had to think of, okay, how we make this fast and snappy, how we do caching, how we are not sure that, have to make sure that it doesn't scan your whole application again when you change just a tiny little bit. These were the challenges that we had to make it work, because nobody likes it when you change something or you change just one line and it takes over 30 seconds to re-render the stuff. So the most of the challenges were in the usability kind of way.
What about security vulnerabilities like in the dependency tree? So are you guys scanning all the way down or just at like the top level?
We're scanning all the way down. We scan, so that's why we need your whole dependency tree.
Okay.
With the use of things like npm or with the package log file. We know what kind of dependencies are underneath, because we found out that most problems are not in the top level dependencies but in the dependencies underneath. So
yep, exactly.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And that's what we show you. It's not that package that you might imported, but it can be something that is 3 or 4 levels deep.
I should have added too. I'm still scrolling through. So this isn't just anything that I were to import, but it works with script tags as well.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the thing I like about it. Actually, it's my side favorite thing about it. It's actually not even targeting specifically like, you know, full blown NPM JavaScript developers using import and TypeScript and so on. But if you're just editing a file, like, you know, plain old, I don't know, the days of the 90s where you have a script tag there importing something.
A lot
something.
Of people still do that.
that's what I'm getting at. That's my favorite thing. We have not neglected that part, and we've actually very consciously actually have looked into parsing those, you know, plain HTML files and script tags and using that to find out what you're using and so on.
All those good old monolithic Ruby on Rails and Django apps.
Exactly.
Not just that. I'm actually a fan of script tags. Yeah, done right. You know,
it's not so bad. You can still import with them.
No, done right, the web is a beautiful thing. You know, a script tag will always have a place, unless you're using ES modules where you can do the import from within the JavaScript itself. And everything ultimately translates to a script tag. Well, there's also web workers which aren't script tags. But anyway. Many things translate.
We don't need script tags. Just put everything in the on-click one line. It's safe, it's secure, loads really fast.
That's true.
Yeah, go to
easy to use.
OnClick equals string. That's, you know, having code as strings, that's always secure.
Yeah. What could possibly go wrong? Nothing. It's perfect.
Nobody will notice, right?
When you're programming that way, you've got so little JavaScript in your code that your code's inherently, hopefully not even code.
Yeah, actually people will notice because your website will work surprisingly fast.
Let's not troll too hard. People might believe that.
But it's actually true. Cool. So anything else you want to tell us about either this extension or other extensions that you're or free tools that you're introducing?
Well, after creating this extension, we were thinking about, okay, that integration with an IDE is very common and it's very useful for developers. But how do you get into the process of picking a certain library? And you probably search around on different websites. It can be either a CDN or that, and you use that script tag. Or it can be, for instance, another website that you can look for a specific library that fixes or helps you with the problem you want to solve. So we reached out to a couple of those owners. And for instance, with JS Deliver and with CDN.js, we integrated our API with them. So if you are looking for a certain package, same with Yarn, by the way, Yarn package. If you're searching for a certain, for a package and you're like, okay, I like that package, and you click on the details, you will see a bunch of these badges. And the badges normally are like, okay, what kind of license is it? How much is it downloaded? But also gives you an indication of a specific version, how many vulnerabilities are there? And just in a one-liner, right on top of mind, like, okay, this version might have two vulnerabilities. Do you want to use it, or do you want to go to a newer or maybe even older version? Depends on what it is. Most of the time it's newer, by the way. And if you want to know more, you can click on it and you go to our website that gives you more in-depth information on what kind of vulnerabilities are there. So we think, like, by giving this information early and often to the community, we tried basically to make it easy for developers to pick the right package initially. So that's one of the things we recently did next to the Vonkast plugin and the integration with this website vulnerable, web page test, sorry.
Again, without naming names, how vulnerable was the most vulnerable package that you've yet to encounter?
That's a good question. I don't think I've ever put them on a scale like that.
No, it's and it's then it's,
I can think of some from my NPM days for sure.
I can think of some, but it's how you also count the vulnerabilities. Because do you count a vulnerability as one, or do you count every vulnerable path that it can take as a vulnerability? So that's the way. Like, okay, how do you actually come to the numbers? But
Like that scene from the Lord of the Ring movie where the elf Legolas takes down that elephant with all the fighters on it, and then Gimli the dwarf says, yeah, that only counts as one. So yeah, I guess it really depends on how you count
it really depends, because it's basically the same vulnerability, but yeah, you can trigger it in say a ton of different ways. So do you count it as one vulnerability, or do you count it as a ton of vulnerabilities? But I've seen, say, in within the three digits, so over 100 vulnerabilities I've seen to a package. But that was a very, very old one, and I'm not naming anybody in this case.
Hey, it's Charles Maxwood, and yeah, this is an ad. Real quickly, you're probably tired of some of the ads that we have in the shows, or maybe you're just looking for a way to support the podcast. Well, I just set up a new thing where you can get the podcast without the ads, and you can just donate $9 a month to the podcast so that we can keep things rolling. Sponsorships lately have been a little bit tricky to come by, and so we've been added to some of the ad platforms and things like that so that I can pay the folks that edit the show. But if you want to pay the folks directly to edit the show, you can do that. Go to javascriptjabber.com/premium, and if you sign up for $9 a month, then we will use that money to run the podcast network. And you'll be able to get the show without the ads. So once again, that's javascriptjabber.com/premium.
But in most cases, though, is it about the number or the severity? Because I would imagine that a single severe vulnerability can be much worse than 20, you know, small vulnerabilities.
That totally depends on the context of your application. Just to give you an example, something like a path traversal kind of vulnerability might look like, okay, you can traverse backwards in a path and I can read a bunch of files that might not be, you cannot do anything. You can just read. But that is, however, the start of how people get into your application. So they might be reading, for instance, a token that you left out there in a certain file that you normally only can read if you have access to that file system. If you combine two or three individually low severe vulnerabilities, but you combine these two or these three, they can still lead up to a massive destruction of your application, or at least things you did not intend to expose to the outside world. So it totally depends on your on the context. However, I do agree that things like arbitrary code execution or these kind of vulnerabilities are by default are more severe. So I would say if you're going to solve things, start with the high severe ones and go away to the lower ones. But don't underestimate the lower or medium vulnerable vulnerabilities that are out there, because combined, they can do a lot of things. And most of the times, unfortunately, it's not just one issue you have. When you found out you got breached, it's probably a domino effect from three or four or more vulnerabilities that people combined to get into your system or read certain data or whatever it is they want to do with your stuff.
Hey, folks, this is Charles Maxwood, and I just launched my book, The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. It's up on Amazon. We self-published it. I would love your support. If you want to go check it out, you can find it there. The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. Have a good one. Max out.
Yeah. So I actually have two questions about that. So we were discussing the fact that sometimes smaller vulnerabilities in the libraries that you're using can accumulate, and that several small vulnerabilities can actually add up into a significant vulnerability. So I actually have two questions related to that. Question number one is that if I look at it from that perspective, it can be an accumulation of vulnerabilities from several libraries. That means I might be using, maybe the problem is because I'm using two specific libraries in conjunction. Is that something that you're also looking at or considering looking at?
I don't think if there was an example that I remember out of my head just because of combining two vulnerabilities, but there are definitely situations, and I think that's kind of like probably apparent in the the vulnerability, the security scene, where you would be like a chain of things going kind of like wrong together, if so to say, would need to impact the vulnerability. So for example, we have probably give two examples that off the top of my hand, because these are exploits we have on the public goof up, which I've mentioned before. And so, for example, let's say there's an XSS vulnerability in a package called Marked, doing Markdown, and you know this is a real thing, right? And by default, in that version of Marked, it actually sanitized those vulnerabilities. Those specific strings, like a JavaScript colon something, and then you can't really do an XSS in an href context. And so, if you try to replace that colon with something like the HTML entity representation of what a colon is, it actually does some regex parsing to find those as well. So that by itself, like trying both of those things didn't really work. And
I love sanitation using regex. It's what can go wrong?
Exactly.
Nothing, but because regular expressions are precise and regular.
Yeah, and they're so easy to debug and understand.
Yeah, unless you write them like Dan does, God,
just don't try them at all. But
we had this an interesting Twitter exchange about me taking a simple, like three simple regular expressions and turning them into, or actually three simple replace instructions and turning them into one not so simple replace instruction, because I like to write code like a compiler. But anyway, go on. So yes, using regular expressions to sanitize your code.
Right. So I mean, it's interesting to note at this point that this maintainer was actually very security conscious. I mean, think about the mindset. Someone, you know, understanding that a payload like JavaScript colon, you know, then alert or something could be, malicious. Then thinking about the fact that someone can represent it in a different way and then sanitizing HTML entities. I mean, that's you have got to give, you know, some credit here, right? I mean, this is a, you know, very security mindset in a way, and we'd love to see more of that. The thing is, that regex specifically like targeted a structured way of that HTML entity. So if you would break the HTML entity down a bit to where it's like, where it has, you know, it's supposed to end with like a semicolon, but if you'd add a valid JavaScript statement or like, you know, like the word this or the word document before that semicolon and, you know, right onto the end of the HTML entity, what would happen is it would actually bypass the sanitization process in Markt because that's not, you know, according to the regex. So that's supposedly fine. But then the browser thinks about it in a different way. And then when the browser parses that, the browser actually inserts that semicolon, creates an HTML entity, and the rest of that statement is all valid JavaScript. And that's how you get an XSS. And that's, for example, like one way where you might be thinking and trying different ways to exploit a vulnerability. Like, you know, Snyk will tell you, there's an XSS here, and you're like driving or, you know, driving nuts about how to make it happen, you know, QA it or, you know, try to see what's going under. Might not, you know, think about this specific attack vector as a security researcher did, and then, you know, filed a security report about it. So things aren't, you know, as simple as they seem all the time. Some things, you know, require different chain of things to happen. You know, that's one example. I have more of those, but I don't know about, like, you know, different libraries. I think that's, these are more complex situations, but definitely things are oftentimes, you know, a bit more than they are complicated than they appear to be.
So that was one question that I had. And the other is, currently you're researching vulnerabilities or getting reports about vulnerabilities in third-party libraries. And then based on that, you're recommending, you said either usually upgrade, sometimes a downgrade. What about inspecting or using certain heuristics to verify my own code? Because anything a third party library can do, I can also do myself accidentally.
No, we're not doing that yet, but Brian, do you know that reachable vulns feature we have for Java? I think that's something worth and really interesting to share about because, yeah, Snyk does like this tooling, which is, you know, more of like a developer first kind of tooling that we're trying to build. But then it does this other aspect, which you mentioned, which is, you know, we do our own security research and you know, have a way to report on vulns so we can work with the maintainers to fix them. But recently we've done something very much related to what you're saying. It's currently only out for Java, and that's more around the fact where sometimes you have it's not exactly your code, but it's as close to it as you can get at this point, and that is, let's say you're using, you know, a third-party dependency, but the thing is the vulnerable function that is part of that dependency that, you know, has the vulnerability inside it, maybe you're not using it, right? And it's a very classic case, for example, from the JavaScript side, from like things like Lodash, where you'd import, you know, the entire of Lodash, but maybe that, you know, there's like only that merge function, which you don't use, is vulnerable, but the tooling still tells you, you know, upgrade Lodash because, you know, merge is vulnerable, but you're not using it, right? That's kind of like the frustration part. And so we have it right now for Java where you could pass some flags out to the CLI or, you know, where we have some like integrations with the IDE and so on, where we can leverage this information. And then we can tell you it's actually only vulnerable if it's from a reachable code. So only if it's, you're actually using a code path that triggers that specific vulnerable function, because Snyk also knows to say, what is the actual function that is vulnerable within that third-party library? It's not just, you know, that third-party library in version is vulnerable, but what is the actual function that is vulnerable? And then we can connect all of that flow together and tell you what you should be doing. So I think that's the key part that, you know, we want to see more happening across other ecosystem languages too.
Yeah, definitely. For the Java ecosystem, we now look into that to actually see if it's part of the call graph. So if it's actually reachable, that is not, of course, 100% certainty, but then we can give you, together with if there are known exploits for it, together with, what is the, how high is the CVSS score, all these things combined, we can give you a score to see, which one should you fix first, because what we see for enterprise developers or developers with a lot of code, they have a bunch of vulnerabilities. They have a ton of vulnerabilities that they need to fix. Like, okay, where to start? So that is the thing that we do. So we see if it's reachable or not. That's one of the major pilots over there. And then, of course, if it's out there for a very long time or a very new one, that influences the score, and that will change over time. Of course, all these kind of things. Just like it can be that something comes out and it turns out to be a false positive. Luckily, we have our own security team that monitors these kind of things. So in a very rare situation, it can be that the severity will change from high to medium or something like that. Or even if it's a real false positive, it will not be flagged anymore. So that is the benefit, in my opinion, from having our own security researchers inside our company.
Cool. I think at this point I will push us towards picks. It's been quite a very interesting discussion for me, and there's certainly been a lot of information here.
One of the biggest pain points that I find as I talk to people about software is deployment. It's really interesting to have the conversations with people where it's, I don't want to deal with Docker, I don't want to deal with Kubernetes, I don't want to deal with setting up servers, I don't, you know, all of these different things. And in a lot of ways, DevOps has gotten a lot easier. And in a lot of ways, DevOps has also kind of embraced a certain amount of culture around applications, the way we build them, the way we deploy them. And I've really felt for a long time that developers need to have the conversations with DevOps or adopt some form of DevOps so that they can take control of what they're doing and really understand when things go to production, what's going on, so that they can help debug the issues and fix the issues and find the issues when they go wrong and help streamline things and make things better and slicker and easier so that they'll more generally go right. So we started a podcast called Adventures in DevOps. And I pulled in one of the hosts from one of my favorite DevOps shows, Nell Shamrell Harrington from the Food Fight show. And we got things rolling there. And so this is more or less a continuation of the Food Fight show where we're talking about the things that go into DevOps. So if you're struggling with any of these operational type things, then definitely check out Adventures in DevOps. And you can find it at adventuresindevopspodcast.com.
I don't know if you guys are familiar with this pick concept. Hopefully you are. If not, we will do our picks and then you'll probably get the gist of what it is. So because Amy had to drop off, AJ, why don't you go first? You usually have great, awesome picks.
Yeah, all right. So last week I talked about Zalgo and then there were crickets, because I somehow we're with a crowd that doesn't know what Zalgo is. These guys know what Zalgo is, right? You guys know Zalgo, no? Oh, man.
What's going on?
What, started being a developer yesterday? Come on. Oh. Zalgo is the demon god that comes when you parse HTML with regex. This is kind of like, it's...
Why would you ever do that? That's why we don't know about it. We don't do these kind of like awful things.
Oh, well, I mean, it's one of the most famous Stack Overflow posts. It's like that Amazon review of the three wolf moon t-shirt. You know, it's just one of those things that, yeah.
Only you know about these things.
And you know, and on that note, I'm going to pick the Three Wolf Moon Amazon review. It's a parody review. And like this thing about Zalgo obviously is a parody answer. But actually I don't know. Somebody will have to Google it. I don't know what the link is. But anyway, there's a bunch of, if you Google for like parody reviews on Amazon, there's stuff people talking about, like getting delivered like month old milk and gender-specific BIC pens and like just really weird random stuff. Okay, so another one that I've got to pick is the Fish shell. If you are not using Fish, you deserve better. Now, I am not going to suggest that you take any effort in learning how to script with Fish, because I think that's a waste of time. Now someone's going to shoot me from the Fish community. But Fish is the best shell. It is the friendly, interactive shell. And it does things like, as you type, it highlights what you're typing. It doesn't wait for you to hit tab or hit return to start doing auto suggestions and error feedback. Like, While you're typing, if the command's not found, it's going to be highlighted in red. And then as soon as the command's found, it turns into blue. And it's just got, it's like, if you've heard of Oh My ZSH, it's like Oh My ZSH on steroids. And by the way, if you cannot, just cannot use a shell that isn't bash compatible because you do too much bash foo, then there's no way that you haven't heard of ZSH and Oh My ZSH. But if on the rare chance you are a bash foo guru who does not know of ZSH, then you can also use ZSH. But I recommend Fish. I always use bash for scripting. I never try to do anything fancy in Fish, but just as a way to just, you know, type out commands and files and folders. And I just love having all the auto completions and highlighting and colors, et cetera, et cetera. So I've got an installer and cheat sheet up for that on webinstall.dev/fish. And that'll show you how to integrate it with iTerm2 or with terminal.app. I tend to try to stay away from things that require sudo. So you can also set it to your default shell with sudo and chsh, but I try to avoid that. And then along those lines, I'll pick this again later, but there's a couple themes that I've discovered that I really love for iTerm2, and VS Code, and like these themes are pretty much universal, but there's a theme called, Tomorrow Night, that's part of the base 16 package of themes. And then there's another one called Toy Chest and another one called Dracula. So I'm going to pick Toy Chest. Well, Tomorrow Night, first of all, then Dracula, then Toy Chest. And I've discovered this new thing with iTerm2 where I can use in the advanced tab, I can set it so as soon as I SSH into something, all of my SSH users are app, which I think that's a pretty common convention. So I'm not giving away any information there, and I don't use passwords. I only use keys. So whenever I SSH into something that has the username app, the profile switches. So if I'm on a remote computer, I don't get confused between which terminal is which. So I'll have like my remote will be in the Toy Chest theme and my local will be in Dracula. And then I'll have a really ugly theme for the default theme. So if it's my username, then it shows up in one theme. If it's the app username, it shows up in another theme. And then if it's the root username, then it shows up in another theme. That way, I never get confused. And this requires iTerm2 and the terminal integrations under the like iTerm preferences tab or whatever. But it's super awesome. Absolutely love it. I've got that to pick. And then, okay, I'm gonna pick a really, really unpopular figure for a very good reason. I'm going to pick Jeff Bezos because he is the flippin' modern Robin Hood. He's figured out how to get rich people from all the globe to invest in a company that drives up an inflated imaginary valuation so that he's quote unquote worth $200 billion when in fact he's actually just stolen all the rich people's money, lowered the cost of goods and services, and then provide it to everybody for free or near free.
Amazing.
I like those are my picks. Oh yeah, I think Jeff Bezos is getting such a bad rap right now, but like people don't understand how company valuation works. He doesn't have $200 billion. He spent some amount of billions of dollars that after you do these adjustments for stock price, inflations, et cetera, it's imaginary money. You're just making it up. It doesn't exist in the real world. It's not something you can pull out of a bank account or...
Yeah, you know. But all money is imaginary. You can't really pull all the money out of the bank accounts anyway.
Well, what I mean is like...
Shared psychosis.
Imagine that like there was no gold and then you dug and you found gold and suddenly you're rich. Like the gold didn't exist before, but then you found it. So it's not like
it's called cryptocurrency.
You didn't. No, that's. But you didn't. You didn't
it's take a different kind money. Of gold.
You didn't take money from poor people to get rich. You created a new asset where no asset previously existed.
Well, again, we're living in an economy where the governments or actually the central banks keep pouring money into the economy. So literally, the concept of pouring money out of thin air. It's not even that you don't even print the bills anymore. It's just numbers in a computer. It's becoming literally meaningless. It's like I said, it's a shared psychosis. But I understand where you're coming from. I'm just amused because I think the Federal Reserve is pouring the equivalent of one Jeff Bezos into the U.S. economy literally every month. So it kind of puts things in perspective.
Well, no, they're doing much more than that because he only actually gets salaried at, I think it's $10 million per year. And they're putting a lot more than that into, and yeah. But again, that's dilution. But we do need inflation. Inflation is important for a stable economy.
So I'm going to go now with my picks. So pick number one is, you mentioned the themes. So I'm always amused when somebody posts a bit of code on Twitter. And usually the way to do it these days is to post a screenshot, and he goes like, or he or she goes and says, hey, look at this really awesome code that I created, or I created this algorithm which solves a problem which was considered to be unsolvable before, and I did it small enough so that it can fit in a tweet. And everybody says, yeah, but what's your theme? So I'm always amused about that. And in this context, my pick is going to be that if you do actually post code on Twitter as an image, it's a really cool way of sharing code, especially if your code doesn't quite fit in the tweet itself. But the thing that we neglect to think about is the fact that visually impaired people can't actually see your code because it's text in a picture, and the screen readers can't handle that. And what you can actually do in Twitter these days is add alt text, like you can do with images on the web. You can actually do that in Twitter. So my first pick is going to be that if you at any time post code on Twitter as an image, make sure to include all that code as an alt text for that image. People who are not visually impaired will just see that image that you posted along with your really nifty theme, but visually impaired people will actually get their screen readers to read out the code for them. So that's going to be my first pick. My second pick is going to be the series of books, fantasy books that I've been reading. They're not the best fantasy series that I've ever read, but they're very enjoyable. I'm having fun time reading them. It's the Demon Cycle series. I'm about to finish book number two, and I'm definitely going to be reading book number three. So that would be my second pick, and I'll post the link to Goodreads about that series of books. And that concludes my picks for today. So, Brian, let's go with you first. Do you have picks for us, or should I switch over to Liran before you?
Try later on first, because I'm trying to make up what should I pick in what category. I'm trying to make
it could be anything, literally. It doesn't need to have anything to do with technology whatsoever. It could be your hobby or whatever. Or just a random just thing that happened today.
He's a Java person, so you know it takes time to boot up, you know.
I've got multiple threads to spun up to do this for me, right? Let's not get into
this. Yeah, you've got the pick, but you're still creating all the boilerplate for it.
Definitely, but it makes it readable.
I like you, Dan.
Okay, I will take a pick. That's what something like bit of in the same fashion as you called out, Dan, but. Although now I have to rethink of that because of that that alt tag that you mentioned, but I just stumbled upon carbon.now.sh, where you can literally grab a piece of code and push it in, and then it will create an image that looks like your terminal in a certain way, and you can mix and match themes in these kind of way, so you have an actual nice picture kind of way to post it. In a blog post or in a Twitter message that looks far better and far, well, easier to read, in my opinion, than people just having a screen grab from their own screen, because they, well, at least they have a nice background on it. You can pick and choose whatever you want, but I think it's a very nice way to present your code as an image in, for instance, a blog post. Although I would say that if you blog somewhere, and it's possible just to put it out as code and use Markdown, for instance, that should be your first pick. The other pick, I think I will pick a TV series. And probably everybody knew about this one, but I haven't have stumbled upon this like literally last week and binged it. That was The Umbrella Academy, which is so addictive, in my opinion. It is weird. It is strange. It is kind of superhero, but not really. After this this meeting, I will probably put one of these episodes up just to clear my mind of all the JavaScript things that Laurent throws at me. No, I'm kidding, man. I'm kidding.
Did you watch both seasons?
I'm currently I binged for season one. I'm currently somewhere in within season two, and
that one is mostly like The Boys, right?
Sort of. Boys is same, more same.
The Boys. I've seen it as well. The Boys have seen it as well. I have to start in the second season, but that's more of the anti way of looking at superheroes.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
And that's I must say that's also very very amusing to see it. That superheroes are not your average good guy, but can do things to just they're misusing their powers to just make money and that kind of stuff. So it's just the whole enterprise around superheroes, which is amusing. But I fell for that Umbrella Company thing on Netflix.
Yeah, they're supposed to have one more season of it. I'm not sure when it's supposed to come out. And that's supposed to be the last one. So it's going to be only three seasons. That's it.
Good to know.
But I'm not exactly sure when that third season will actually land, especially with all, you know, the things that are going on. Yeah, but I agree with you. It's a really enjoyable show. I actually picked it myself a couple of episodes ago.
Okay. Well, I will conclude my picks with these two if that's okay.
All right. I guess I'll stay on the tech side. To complete the Fish and the ZSH kind of recommendation, I'll recommend you take a look at Starship Prompt. It's an open source project. Really prettifying your prompt on the shell built by Matan Kushner. It's a really, really, really beautiful thing. So try it out. I feel like I need to give a shout out to you, Yarn too. Mile has put a lot of work into basically rewriting this thing from scratch. And if there is something we could always use is, you know, more opinions, more perspectives, and more ways of looking at things differently. So I think Yarn too is definitely challenging the way that package managers work. That's going to be a nice one. Check it out. I want to shout out for Vuetify, which is a Vue.js theming thing. It might seem obvious, the obvious pick for some of you folks, but I'm bad at front end, and UI component libraries are helping me build things. So definitely a shout out for that one. And maybe the last pick on kind of like packages and projects is take a look at the Pact framework. If you're into testing, you know, in a big way. And one of the challenges there is how do you do API testing, integration testing in scale? So like imagine, you know, having thousands of microservices or don't even need to go to 1,000, right? Tens or hundreds is just kind of like crazy enough. How do you test them in a way where you don't need to bring up a whole end-to-end system to do it? And then the front end and the back end, APIs, integration, and so on. Pact is the way to solve that. And it's based on this concept and pattern that has been here for a while called consumer-driven contracts. So this has a really thriving community. I really suggest taking a look at it. And I'll conclude my picks with a person that will be, I won't say to contradict the Jeff Bezos side of things, but I'll throw you back something like 30 years back. And I'll pick Andrew Milner, which most chances no one is listening has an idea who this person is. But they have, they were the sole creator of a bulletin board system that used to run on DOS called Remote Access. And that has basically shaped up my entire childhood back in 1995 or six or something around those days. So that's going to be my pick.
Cool. Well, that concludes another JavaScript Jabber show. Thank you all for participating. It was awesome. Really, really interesting. If anybody wants to reach out to you guys to learn about vulnerabilities in general, the tools that you're creating, how do they best reach out to you?
I think the easy way is to reach us on Twitter. Both of our DMs are open, And that's why how we connect with basically the rest of the world. Of course, you can use the old-fashioned email kind of way, which is still valid. But I think Twitter is the easiest one. And I think if you look for
your Twitter handle,
it's Brian Verm. So Brian and V E R M at the end. That's my Twitter handle. And Liran is just your name, right?
Almost. It's Liran _ Tal.
Cool. So thank you both for coming on our show. Like I said, it was awesome, really interesting.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. See you all next time. Bye.
See ya. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.